took IBM 20 releases, 20 issues of their OS before they got to this point. It was a big effort. What needs to be done is to make a bitmap in core that represents every instruction in the program and set the bit when you use that instruction. It's slow, it's time consuming, but it pays dividends. And just keep writing test programs until you've written one gigantic test program that tests the whole system. That doesn't mean you've tested every path. All it means is that you've looked at every part, something that you'd probably do anyway in hardware. The effectiveness of testing is difficult to assess. A gal by the name of Lucille Diamond, who's talked at this meeting before, and another fellow by the name of Bob Blay, he's a Lockheed guy, got the idea that if you looked at the fleas that you caught and then went after the fleas again in another way and found out how many you caught that time, you could probably guess how many were left. And this is kind of that type of approach. What's left as a function of what you found? And I think if you stumble through the arithmetic like I did, it's really quite simple. You just make an assumption, and if the assumption isn't right, you change it until you get some figures that agree with the data you have. In hardware, we've been able to show that good testing will catch 90% of the errors. In other words, you're making an order of magnitude improvement for every different kind of test. The first time you mow your lawn this way, you mow almost all of the lawn. When you go across, you're mowing it differently. I'm not talking about repeating the same test. I'm talking about doing another kind of test, still at the system level. And so if you can get sufficient of these, you can reduce your original order of magnitude of error by the number of different tests you can produce, if your tests are good. I don't think that we can get much above 50% a reduction in error for a test today in software. We just don't know how to devise good tests. So you probably won't see anything like an 82%. That I've shown up here. These are fictitious figures. It takes an awful lot more testing to get bugs out than this would indicate. So if we put all these together, we can make an estimate and bound it by taking the product and taking the minimum, and then we'd have a figure. And that 79 is just the midpoint there around the 77 and 81. And that's a statistic that you can give management. You can tell them, all right, this software is according to my calculations, 79% ready, and I'm confident of this within 2%. Another person can repeat that calculation and get the same thing. The figure may not be too meaningful, but it's something you can track. If you get better, that figure is going up. If you get worse, that figure is going down. And you'd be amazed how poor it is when you actually try this out in your own system. If you get above 50%, you've got something that's pretty good. So, in conclusion, we'd like to point out that there are quite a few things that the reliability engineer can do. They have the same titles as in hardware. The failure analysis is the hardest one, no question about it. When the reliability engineer can get in and analyze dumps from system crashes and find out where the error is, what caused them, and how to correct them, and be able to see that they were corrected properly, he will have gone a long way. The other things are fairly easy to do right now. Watch the design, see that it's doing what is intended. Does it meet the specification, not only the software spec, but the system spec? Do the system design engineers of the entire hardware software system, do they think it works this way? We can do a little statistical analysis, as we pointed out, and we can find other techniques to use. The purpose of the paper, as we stated initially, was to get some of you interested. I hope perhaps this has been accomplished. Thanks.
we have some questions? Yes, please come over to the microphone.
My name is Rolf Olson with W.V. Sterling Incorporated. You indicated that your procedures here were applied only to supervisory programs. Can you explain what different requirements, if any, are necessary or desirable for application programs?
Well, first, you need the entire area of numerical analysis, convergence tests, and things like this to make sure that your mathematics is correct and is going to give you the answer you want, this sure. entire area. Another one is that are you using the right method? For example, if you wanted to calculate the sine of an angle, you'd use the sine function if it was less than 45 degrees, and you'd use the cosine function if it was larger than 45 degrees. So that you've got to make sure that you have the right algorithm. And you have to have means for detecting when the application program is not doing what it is supposed to, so that it can pass this back to the executive, and the executive can select the right algorithm for doing the job.
Yes, it's rather obvious that there's more needed, but it seems to me that most of the things that you said here would also be applied as part of an overall evaluation of an application program.
I think so, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Just didn't want to get into the detail of numerical analysis and some of this stuff.
Time for one more question, please.
It's an interesting point you made about...
You can identify yourself, Erwin.
Erwin Nathan, Xerox. It's an interesting point you made about not having a constant hazard in terms of your crash rate. It turns out, in a study that I did about almost 8-9 years ago, with a system that required additional instrumentation and had test thoroughness, which is the ability to detect failures, which was less than 100%, that even if your fundamental hazard rate is constant, the overall system assumes a hazard rate which is not constant, because you come in there with errors that you have not found that will catch you later on, and this kind of thing builds up, and you get, I think it looks like a kind of a decreasing hazard, which would give you a clustering effect, the kind of thing you're talking about. The paper was in the R&M conference about 7 or 8 years ago. You might be able to use that, I think, but that verifies your observations.
Yeah. There's another thing that most errors are corrected, but not all of them. Most errors are corrected correctly, but not all of them.
Right.
So these two serve to force you to work with truncated data, and the statistics for handling truncated data, in other words, an error corrected represents a truncation of the hazard function of that error. So that we've done some work with a negative binomial that's mentioned in the paper, but actually the statistics needed for handling the model of the rate at which crashes will appear just hasn't been done yet.
Well, I think you could get it using your data. I think you could get it from this analysis in this paper. I'd be reasonably sure you could. Also, you would be able to find out, in order to optimize your reliability, how much test thoroughness you needed.
How much what?
How much test thoroughness? How well you can detect and correct. This had both ends of it. It had the recognition of a failure, being that was not 100% perfect, and it had the fact that that even after your test equipment itself had an error rate in it, or your ability to test, whatever it was, in other words, less than 100% certain that you've looked at everything, and those things trade off in terms of some parameter, which could get you to an optimum reliability, and the model, of course, is no longer constant hazard. You don't have to know the distribution, as a matter of fact. It comes out to optimize your reliability function, which is really what you want to get.
Yeah, the only problem is that many times you have the evidence of an error, but you don't find it.
Oh, that too. those things were in there also, where you thought you had an error and you didn't have an error, but you took the system down, you know, and that's part of your interruption rate or whatever, your crash rate.
I think we'll have questions for our panel session. I've been asked by the management committee to announce during the panel that somewhere inside your badges, there's a little card in which you're supposed to vote for best speaker and best panel session at the symposium. I hope that you will all, before you leave the symposium, make certain that you fill that out and drop it in any of the numerous boxes around the symposium. We have... had two papers so far that have discussed software reliability, and now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we'll start discussing more in terms of hardware reliability. I think you'll find that the speakers will still have an interest in the overall system aspects, but what they're going to discuss now is primarily the reliability of hardware computer systems. Our first speaker on this topic will be Dr. S.A. Shigenda. Steve Shigenda got his master's and PhD degrees in computer science from Northwestern University. From 1962 through 1968, he was a member of the technical staff at Bell Laboratories. He worked on the Titan project, the Apollo project, and ESS, which, as most of you probably know, stands for Electronic Switching System, one of the biggest, perhaps, non-military real-time hardware-software complexes, non-military, non-space. Between 1968 and 1970, he was with the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science of the University of Missouri. At present, he's a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at Southern Methodist University. Steve's interests are in simulation, diagnosis, and test of digital systems, and with a special interest in ultra-reliable computers.
This presentation will primarily consider the topic of diagnosis of digital computing systems. For this discussion, I will define diagnosis as a procedure for detecting and or locating faults defined as physical defects in a system, which may occur. We will consider some early work performed in this area, as well as some of the inadequacies of this work. Digital simulation will be discussed as one of the primary tools for enhancing computer reliability and maintainability. The discussion will continue with the consideration of capabilities and techniques utilized in a test generation and simulation system named TGAS-2, which was developed at SMU for the Naval Weapons Laboratory. Finally, I'll conclude with some cautious predictions for the future. Approaches to reliability and maintainability in computing systems are widely varied. However, they can be classified as either hardware or software techniques. Hardware techniques usually incorporate some form of redundancy. We will define redundancy, at least I will, as the existence of parasitic equipment in a system's configuration. The parasitic hardware does not, under fully operational conditions, participate in the computational tasks defined for the system. There are three basic levels of redundancy. Systems level redundancy, where we have subsystem replication. This would be a TMR, triple modular redundant system, duplicate and match system, various systems utilizing spare modules. The problem with this system is obviously one of fault isolation. You can mask the failure, but you better be able to isolate it eventually, or you've got big problems. Replacement level redundancy, which also covers selective redundancy, this includes such things as test points. It's interesting to note, as far as I'm concerned, we still don't know how to utilize test points in a system. The reason for this, I feel, is that we have inadequate simulators to help us determine where we should locate these test points. And finally, a coded redundancy, which is obviously the error detecting and error correcting codes. One must be careful with coded redundancy, since this presupposes a knowledge of failure modes. Used judiciously, though, it could be quite attractive. The major drawback to redundancy is cost. This is obviously more true with respect to systems redundancy than the other two approaches. Hence, wide use of redundancy in a system has been restricted to systems requiring high reliability, such as a number one electronic switching system, which is a duplicated system, SAGE, which was duplicated, Saturn V, which is a triplicated system, Polaris Fire Control, which is a duplicated system, and a Jet Propulsion Laboratory self-test and repair, which uses a combination of techniques, one of these being residue codes. The use of selective redundancy is more attractive cost-wise if one could achieve the required reliability. Recent work in this area shows considerable promise for the future. An added advantage of hardware redundancy is concurrent diagnosis, that is, diagnosis being performed without interruption of normal system tasks. This approach often requires software diagnosis for fault resolution, although this need not be the case. Now let us consider software diagnosis, that is, the use of computer programs for diagnostic test production, validation, and in many cases, test application. First, let's consider some possible properties of a diagnostic procedure. Obviously, these are periodic diagnoses when we're talking about software. The procedure must be executable every few hours. Production cost must be tolerable, the major problem. Diagnosis must be concurrent with user services, and procedure must be general. The implementation of a diagnostic procedure requires a tester capable of applying an input vector, observing an output, and computing the next input, drivability and observability. Diagnosis may be either external, where subcomputer A drives the test to subcomputer B and observes the responses, or internal, where the machine under diagnosis is used as a tester. In this case, the same input is applied and compared against previously derived output conditions for the good machine. An early approach to software diagnosis was diagnostic programming. This approach attempted to exercise the functional units of the system. Regrettably, some people are still using this technique. As far as I'm concerned, the technique was shown to be wholly inadequate. Performing an addition operation does not verify the integrity of the adders. Furthermore, fault isolation was difficult because the function many times was distributed throughout the system. This approach at best tested some of the virtual machine, but usually just exercised the instruction set. Unfortunately, we took that early approach also, so much to blame as anybody. At this stage, we began to realize that for diagnosis to be adequate, one must consider the hardware in detail. This realization gave rise to manual simulation, and with this approach, the designer would observe the drawings and try to determine what input tests would detect faults that could occur in the system. The approach was extremely difficult, time-consuming, and incomplete, with no way of determining the degree of incompleteness, which was frightening. An approach developed to work in conjunction with manual simulation was physical simulation. In this approach, the faults were physically inserted into a prototype system. Then the tests that were manually derived were applied, and the outputs observed, fault dictionary was then produced from this procedure. Obvious limitations of this approach includes cost of prototype, time for insertion, which usually took away from software verification, and hardware changes were disastrous to the fault dictionary. These limitations then gave rise to digital simulation, that is, a computer program used to predict the operation of the actual system under faulty as well as fault-free operation. Early approaches to digital simulation were not very attractive due to the large processor time requirements. Much of this was due to the fact that the early approaches tried to simulate a single fault at a time, where we were concerned with thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands of faults. You could obviously see the time being that would be required. An early significant system, and by early in this area, I'm talking about early 1960s, mid-1960s, was developed by the late Professor Sesher of the University of Illinois. This approach was probably the most significant early approach and the one that gave the most credibility to digital simulation. Let's consider an example using this system, and I'll try to point out the limitations as we progress. First of all, at the single fault assumption, that is, at most one failure has occurred since the last diagnosis. This is not necessary in some existing systems today. Further assumptions were that failures are open diodes, gate output stuck at zero, and gate output stuck at one. The logical stuck at one, stuck at zero assumption. This again is not used in a system we'll discuss later. Every failure maps a sequential circuit into another sequential circuit, which is probably still valid today. Failures are not intermittent. Some interesting work going on in this area presently, still a long way to go. And probably the most questionable assumption was that feedback lines could be momentarily reset even under failure to a known initial state. This we've totally done away with. Consider a simple example here now. We have two AND gates, a NOR gate, feedback, three primary inputs, and an output. The input description looks something like this, where we had the input specified, the output specified, the feedback specified, and A1 then was specified as an AND gate with two inputs, namely X1 and X2. Note that your feedback, R1, must be indicated, and it must be specified as a feedback. This is a very serious objection in a large system. It's difficult to go through and find all global feedbacks. Very time-consuming process. This no longer is necessary. The system then goes through two phases, an organized phase and a simulation or a diagnose phase. The organized logic would look something like this. Now, it's interesting to point out the levels over here. The logic is organized into levels. The necessity for this was that this system was a compiled simulator in that the description of a logic was described and then compiled as a program and executed. Major drawback is that the system is now zero delay. The levels were necessary in order to define the order of evaluation of the elements. During operation, a dictionary was printed where the good machine was always machine one, and the other machines referenced a particular fault. For example, machine number six was A1 to A2 open. The object was to isolate all faults from the good machine, which you remember now machine number one. So the first test, 000, with possible outputs in 0, 0, and 1, isolated in machines 9 and 13 from the good machine. What this means now, 0, 0, 0 could not possibly isolate fault 3 from the good machine, even if fault 3 existed. So we continued on, and finally, after 11th test, 0, 1, 0, fault 1, or machine 1 and 2 are now separated, and you have complete diagnosis. Now, this was a very early approach, and let's consider some of the limitations, and this is not particularly restricted to this approach. That's the last slide. First of all, most simulators were developed for specific systems. As such, they were inflexible, extremely difficult to use, and put a tremendous burden on the user. They were restricted to small logic nets, at best a few thousand elements. Not used effectively for design verification, how could they? They had zero or unit delay. In fact, most simulators today use zero or unit delay. You can't do much design verification with a system like that. Furthermore, I contend that many of the simulators have as their objective to model a model instead of modeling the physical system. If they tried to model the physical system, they would go to a time-based simulator. Required manual test generation resulting in large test sets. Extremely cumbersome to handle and to apply. Restricted to particular hardware techniques. You see simulators for synchronous logic, simulators for asynchronous logic, so forth. Very difficult fault dictionary production because they were restricted to small systems. And since speed was essential in the early days, the techniques were not developed thoroughly. Most of these were written in low-level language, which made them very machine-dependent. The TGAS-2 system, which we have developed, tries to remedy these objections. It's been under development for the last 4 years. System is an element-level simulator. By this, I mean it simulates elements. Now, an element could be a gate, could be a collection of gates, could be a pack, a collection of packs, functional modules, decoders, encoders, so forth. Using this technique, we could simulate very large systems, in fact, total computing systems. It's a table-driven simulator. It's not the conventional compiled type of simulator. Consequently, using table-driven approaches, we now could incorporate timing information. It's written in Fortran, and it's efficient. It's a time-delayed simulator made up of 9 modes of simulation plus test generation. Mode 1 is a 2-value nominal delay simulator. It's not a unit delay simulator, although it could degenerate to that if you cared to. We've been using it in cases as a unit delay simulator to compare results. The nominal delay does not restrict it to a uniform delay for elements. For example, an AND gate with 2 inputs could have a different delay than an AND gate with 3 inputs. This is true throughout all the modes of simulation. Mode 2 is a 3-value nominal delay simulator, which has the third value as an indeterminate bit now, used primarily for initialization for unknown states. Third value simulates an ambiguity region between a minimum and maximum propagational delay of the element. Hence, this critical timing and race and hazard analysis performed. Modes 4, 5, and 6 are simply modes 1, 2, and 3 with fault insertion capabilities. Modes 7, 8, and 9 are modes 1, 2, and 3 with rise and fall considerations and spike analysis. Other techniques utilized in the system are dynamic leveling. Remember where the example levels were shown, and this was done statically in a pre-processed phase. Put a tremendous burden on a user. With a table-driven simulator based on time, it's not necessary. The system is dynamically leveled as one simulates, and consequently, you have no concern with leveling. Dynamic storage allocation, the first version of TGAS did not have this. Many systems have not utilized this technique, and consequently, they can't simulate particular examples because they don't have enough storage. But usually, the lack of storage is in one area, and there's an excess in the other, but they're using static storage techniques, and so they can't utilize it. As I mentioned before, it's a table-driven time delay simulator. It uses selective trace, which increases speed by an order of magnitude. And this is simply a procedure where one follows only those paths through the logic net that changed since the last time. You have the other information available already. It's a parallel modified simulation techniques. We could simulate anywhere from one fault to numerous faults in parallel, nominally the number of bits in a particular host machine word, but it could simulate other groupings of faults. In fact, it could simulate in many cases all faults in one pass. Time flow mechanism for the simulator, which again increased the efficiency by an order of somewhere between 2 and 5, is a fixed time increment along with the next event strategy using linked lists and pointers. Fault models and insertion techniques were not restricted to logical stuck at 1, stuck at 0 models. We could simulate logical transformations, a NAND gate that now operates like an AND gate, an inverter that no longer inverts, shorted signals and shorted diodes, any multiples of these, and any other type of failure that you could describe. As you may guess from this, one of the major objectives of this system was generality of application and ease of use. So we try to keep everything open-ended. And we have some automatic test generation capabilities. In conclusion then, as I promised at the beginning of this talk, I'd like to make some cautious predictions for the future. Limitations of software diagnosis include large manpower commitments, large software systems, incompleteness, and at best you come up with periodic diagnosis. Consequently, I contend this will result in a decrease in the use of software diagnosis. The diagnosis problem will draw more heavily on selective redundancy. As the cost of hardware decreases and these selective redundancy techniques are more fully developed, this will come true. A couple of examples of this, for example, we have designed an adder, simple adder, we've duplicated the adder, and figured out the reliability we've achieved doing this. Then we designed some selective checking techniques for this adder. We found that we came up with precisely the same reliability at 75% of the cost. You question then why people use duplicated adders. Furthermore, done some work on memory systems where we're getting the percent of redundancy down below 25%, and not only achieving fault detection and isolation, but in many cases, automatic self-repair. Use of codes could be more effective. The selective redundancy technique will result in concurrent diagnosis, which is far more attractive than periodic diagnosis. The system will then be under diagnosis during normal operation. We have no software for maintenance, which is probably the most attractive of all. And we have the fault resolution required. With respect to digital simulation, it will be used extensively for a while for software diagnosis and fault dictionary production, probably next 4 or 5 years. After that, it will be used for design verification and for development and verification of selective redundancy techniques. The reason I contend that people have not used more of these selectively redundant techniques is they have no way of verifying how good they are. You design a technique and you put it in a small part of the system, you better be able to verify that it's good and it doesn't affect the rest of the system in a detrimental fashion. In some brief speculations, I feel that this is going to be extremely marketable commodity in commercial systems if we can get the reliability down where it's not as expensive. If I were to approach you with a system that I would be willing to pay penalties on when it goes down, if for you to pay 10% more, I think you would be inclined to go that route. And we're also investigating FAT code, which is a fault-tolerant computer on demand, which would reconfigure itself into fault-tolerant mode when necessary. Most of the systems requiring high reliability don't require it all the time. Hopefully the military ones will never require it, but they stand there and just chug along and wait. And why not use them in commercial mode? Thank you.
Questions?
I thought that gentleman was running for that microphone there. I started a little bit frightened there.
We have one question for you, but we're going to save it for the panel session because it'll take a while. I had said previously that through some fault of my own and through no fault of my own in one case, I could link several of our speakers to Brooklyn Poly in one way or the other. Dick Mulock, I have no way of tracing any association to Brooklyn Poly, but Steve Shigenda has a co-author who unfortunately couldn't make it with us, whose name is Mike Flynn and is well known in many computer circles. I had the opportunity to talk several months ago with a man in the mathematics department at Brooklyn Poly who's just finishing up his PhD in mathematics and computer science, and I said, funny thing, we had submitted a paper by a guy with the same name as yours. His name is Mike Flynn. Do you know him? And he says, sure, he's my older brother. Okay. So I've linked so far three of our speakers to Brooklyn Poly. Now, our concluding speaker will be Dr. Herb Hecht. Dr. Hecht is going to talk about economics of reliability for spacecraft computers. Now, Dr. Hecht spent his early education in a large city in the eastern part of this country. He received his Bachelor of Electrical Engineering degree at City College in 1944, his Master's degree in Electrical Engineering in 1949 at Brooklyn Polytech, his PhD from UCLA in 1967. He is presently Director of Computer and Guidance Technology Programs at the Aerospace Corporation. His work includes flight control and guidance design with special emphasis on reliability. He has been teaching a UCLA summer course, which will be given again this year, which is on the same topic as his talk, essentially, well, the basis. And that course is called Economics of Reliability. Herb?
No, that's...
Thanks very much, Marty. There are a few circumstances that bring me here. One was handy. I was here at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. The second one, that a speaker didn't show up, we should have been here. And the third one was that even though I didn't have any visual material available then, they prevailed upon me to go to work with grease pencil and some acetate sheet and make believe I had it. So what you will see here shortly are some hand scratchings that we put together this morning. My apologies to you. You're a very distinguished audience, and we would not have exposed you to all that if it wouldn't have been for these somewhat extraordinary circumstances. Also, since my paper doesn't appear in the usual sequence in the proceedings there, let me say it's on page 554, towards the back of the book. As Marty said, I want to talk about economics of reliability for spacecraft computers, and this is a very much a hardware-oriented topic. We are here concerned with computers that are installed in a spacecraft destined for a 5 to 7 year life on orbit. Obviously, the possibility of sending a repairman there are rather limited. We are working here with unmanned spacecraft. In manned spacecraft, you have advantages and disadvantages compared to the environment we find ourselves in. Man could conceivably, if he was up there for that period of time, which of course is still far in the future, but he could conceivably undertake some repair and diagnostic activity. On the other hand, in the manned environment, or with a man on board, there would undoubtedly be much more stringent reliability requirements on the computer. What we are addressing here is the area where the reliability of the computer is dictated by economic considerations alone. It's not a safety aspect yet. We are trying to design a computer so that the combination of spacecraft and computer together will have some, will achieve some economic optimum for cost per year on orbit. Basically, the questions that we try to answer here is how deep do we dig in our bag of tricks in order to enhance the reliability of this computer? From what Steve Sigander here has said and what you might have heard at the symposium on fault-tolerant computing in March 71 at Pasadena, for instance, there are today available a tremendous amount of techniques for achieving fault tolerance in computers, ranging, for instance, from gross redundancy to what Steve has called specialized redundancy and at the bit level, for instance, coding techniques, repeated calculations, and things like that. They all have a cost associated with them. In economics of reliability, we try to measure that cost, and we try to arrange these alternatives in an order so that you can then pick off the most cost-effective ones for your your application. I might mention that the field that we are discussing here, economics of reliability, it looks almost as if we are forcing ourselves as a superstructure on top of something that is going on anyhow. And that is true. The decisions that we try to make are being made right now. They're being made typically in a less well thought out fashion. They're made in sometimes leading to acrimonious debates about which method would be better being fought on almost ideological grounds, and we are trying to systematize this. The advantages that we claim for the approach that I'll describe here are: it is organized to identify the required information at an early level. You'll find out what cost figures are required and what reliability figures are really significant. It requires quantitative data, and these quantitative data are fed in at a fairly low level. I think that's an advantage. I would, at downside, rather argue with somebody about the cost of supplying an additional bit line in a memory plane, let's say, rather than arguing about the cost of high-level coding versus low-level coding, things like that. The particular advantage is that the techniques that I will describe are communicable from one organization to another. You can put them down on paper. I work at Aerospace Corporation, we deal with military organizations, we deal with NASA, and we deal with many contractor organizations, people who manufacture computers. It's essential for us to be able to use criteria that both the military and the computer manufacturer will understand. Money turns out to be one of those. And I hope that I will convince you that the techniques are fairly simple, and moreover, this might be heresy in this room, but I have generally emphasized techniques that do not require a computer program. There's nothing wrong, of course, with using a computer to analyze reliability or even to compile cost. But because of this communication problem, because we have to convince many different organizations to look at the same set of figures, I found this at the present time, programs are not completely portable or transferable, and I found it advantageous to stick to techniques that can be carried out with pencil and paper and slide rule. Well, so much about all the goodies that I'm going to give you, and there's some costs associated with these goodies, namely some a certain minimum of mathematics. And let me say that we use mathematics not in the sense of Newtonian mechanics. It is not that precise, it is not that absolute. I rather look at the mathematics that we are using here as a businessman's mathematics, where we are trying to approximate the real world as good as we can with limited period of in a limited period of time and with limited resources. And talking about resources, in spacecraft computers, we have a number of resources that we try to minimize. Each one of them is a goodie that costs us in some way or another. Cost of the manufacturing cost of the computer is one very obvious one. Weight of a computer is another important resource. For low Earth orbits, at present, the cost of orbiting a pound is roughly $1,000. For synchronous or near-synchronous orbits, this goes up to $5,000 or $8,000 per pound. Obviously, we want to minimize weight. Power requirements of a computer are another thing that we try to minimize. Now, at the onset of a program, that is when we are talking about a specific satellite, we can usually identify a dollar trade-off for each one of these additional, for each one of the non-monetary resources like weight or power. And we then trade these off and convert the thing in what I call the general resource for which we will use the symbol capital V in all of these formulas that you will see shortly. And with that, I guess we're ready for the first view graph, as Harry Kimmel has very generously volunteered to flash these on for me. They need a little coddling to be held level and flat because they were just cut off from a roll. Can you maybe down a little lower, Harry, on that one? The basic premise that we deal with is that the cost of an improvement shouldn't be greater than the expected cost of failure that this improvement removes. Now, that's fairly evident, but it's nice to be able to put it in mathematical terms, and we've tried that on the next to the last row there, where we have delta VR. V sub R is the cost of improvement. You might think of it as the value of reliability. And V sub F is the cost of failure. Now, when we introduce an improvement, then the cost of failure goes down, and that accounts for the negative sign in front of V sub F. Now, in the last line, we have tried to be a little more precise. We have here equated cost of reliability to a change in the expected cost of failure. The capital E is the usual expectation operator. Of course, both of them are kind of guesses. We do not know exactly what the cost of reliability will be. But in the cost of failure, we are dealing with a greater uncertainty in two ways. The first one is that the failure probability is typically a small number, 5, 8, 10%. The variability of that number on a percentage basis is much greater than the variability in the cost of the reliability improvement. For instance, we might at worst make an error in the cost of reliability improvement by a factor of 2, but it is not at all unusual that we might make an error by a much greater factor in the failure probability. These spacecraft computers, incidentally, are produced in 1Zs and 2Zs and maybe 4 at one time, so that statistical measures of failure probability are very hard to come by. Well,